So today what I'm going to do is I'm going to basically sketch the proof of boundedness in vertical strip of automorphic Galois functions. Basically the paper of Gelbart and Shahidi. Basically I'll give just the outline with the main arguments. And then I was going to talk about punctuality, but Jim stole my topic this morning. Probably I will just then give a proof of functorial relative symmetric square. Basically, namely the result of Gelbart and Jacquet. So using Langlands-Shahidi method, I can just prove in one page rather than 50 pages.
For the symmetric
proof,
do you use the n-2 converse
theorem? I don't need n-2. I only need n-1. And minus 2 I just use for convenience. It's not necessary. Except the local converse theorem. But the using the getting lift, I don't need. Yeah, n-2 converse theorem. All the L functions are there. So I'll indicate that. Okay. So this will be section 13.2 in my notes. So boundedness in vertical strip. Okay. So here comes the difference between the, as Peter Sinek is insisting, the difference between the full L functions and the finite part of L functions. Okay. So zeta S, the Riemann zeta function is not bounded. It's not bounded in vertical strip. Okay, because this comes from the following proposition. I got it from Kitchmarsh, for example. So if f of s is a Dirichlet series, with the non-negative coefficients, and this is a divergent, then f of s is not bounded in the region for sigma is greater than sigma naught. So s is sigma plus it. So I guess you can look at the Titchmarsh's book, Theory of Functions. But the completed L function is bounded. But you can see the completed one, so namely S1 minus S pi minus S gamma S over 2 zeta S. This is bounded in vertical strip. Okay, so this is the infinite part, and I put this to kill the pole, basically. This bounded in vertical strip because, okay, I will just remind you of the Stirling's formula because of gamma, because gamma basically kills all the growth. Okay, so this is a Stirling's formula, so limit gamma sigma plus it, the absolute value is roughly 1 over 2 pi e to the minus 1 half pi absolute value of t to the sigma minus 1 half as t goes to infinity. So as you can see, this is exponential decay. So this gamma effect controls the growth. So if you complete it, you get the boundedness. So in order to prove the boundedness in vertical strip, we use the Frogman-Lindelof theorem. So let me remind you what they are for those who have never seen this theorem. So this is a theorem to use to prove boundedness in vertical strip. So let f of s be holomorphic in a half strip. sigma A B and T is greater than P naught. And suppose F is a finite order. So finite order basically means that F sigma plus IT is big O e to the t to the alpha for some alpha greater than or equal to 1. Okay, so this is what finite order means. Okay, so we have this following strip here. You have strip. You have A and B. Finite order in this region. In the what? Are here? I'm just looking at only this region. T is positive. Okay, so in this region we are finite order in this region, in this strip. And let's say we have a better bound on this boundary. So we have a better bound. So let's say F A plus I T is O to the T to the nth power. F B plus I T is O to the T to the nth power. Okay? Then conclusion is that F sigma plus I T is O to the T to the nth on the half strip. Okay, so if it is for example, M is 0, for example. So that's F is bounded on this half in the boundary, then F is bounded in the whole strip. So that's the Fragman Lindelof theorem. Okay, so in order to use this theorem in our automorphic L function, so we have this automorphic L function here, S pi R I. So let's say assume this is entire. So we can assume that because if you push by high ramified character. Now we want to show that that's bounded in vertical strip. So this is a completed L function. So in order to apply this Fragman-Lindelof theorem, so we take a vertical strip. Sigma is greater than equal to V, where such that LS pi RI is absolutely convergent at real S equals V. So if it is absolute convergence, then that will be bounded. Okay. So that will imply that LS pi RI is bounded in this half line. So this is A and this B. And so this is outside range of absolute convergence. Now by functional equation, so we have this functional equation. This is epsilon RI L 1 minus S pi RI tilde. So by functional equation, for A is big enough on the left, then it will be again bounded in here. Okay? So by functional equation, same thing will be true. Also on real S equals A. So it is bounded in here and here. Okay? So the only thing we have to check is this one. Finite order. So the only thing we have to check is a finite order. So we only need to check check that this is a final order.
Is A
equal
to 1 minus B?
Oh, yeah, so, okay. 1 minus B, yeah, you can take 1 minus B. It's a final order, okay? Okay, the starting point of, so this is, everything I do is the summary. I'm summarizing the paper of Gelbart and Shahidi. The starting point is the following observation, actually by following theorem. The starting point is the following proposition of Harishchandra, is that this, the global L function, and the global intertwining operator, this, remember that this is the global intertwining operator which appeared in the constant term of Eisenstein series. This is bounded in vertical strip. On the, let's say, let me denote this notation. T epsilon I. So this is SC. Real part of S is in I, and imaginary part of S is greater than epsilon. Okay, so let's look at it this way. And I is the positive interval. So I is the positive real interval. Okay, so this is S has to be, real part of S has to be greater than 0. In the positive real interval, this is a bounded in vertical strip. Okay, so now we have to relate this with the L function. So by, we did that last time by normalizing the intertwining operators. So this was given by, we can normalize the intertwining operator. So this was IS pi RI 1 plus IS pi RI epsilon IS pi RI and the product of local intertwining operators. Normalized local intertwining operator. So this global intertwining operator can be written in that way. And now we have to control these local intertwining operators. So this is the proposition. We can probably prove not so hard. So if at infinite place, the infinite place, this local intertwining operator is a rational function. Is a rational function of S. And at the finite place, and this is a rational function of Q to the negative S, Q V to the negative S. Okay. Anyway, the point is that these are the function of finite order. And the three, this is a one identity. This is V W naught is identity for almost all V. Almost all V. So actually, this is basically the finite product. Basically, it's identity. Okay, so. And also, we have to assume that this is holomorphic. So we need to assume that this local normalized intertwining operator is holomorphic. So it's holomorphic and non-vanishing for real part of S is greater than or equal to 1/2. So this one I talked about last week. We need this for holomorphy of the L functions also. So we need that here too. So if you combine all this, so that will imply that this thing is a function of finite order and non-vanishing. Okay. So this is the function of finite order and non-vanishing. And this is the function of finite order and non-vanishing. So that means that this whole thing, and this is just a monomial. Yeah, so monomial. So it's finite order. So that means that this thing, the quotient of L function is a function of finite order. So that will imply, this whole thing imply that, so this thing is is a function of finite order. For real S bigger than equals 1/2. Not yet. It's a non-vanishing. We are assuming that this. I mean, that's the assumption we made last week. Huh? So I mean, this is a rational function. This is a rational function. So. But I'm assuming that everything is entire. I mean, we can make it. We can get rid of poles. Okay, anyways, this is a function of finite order, this quotient. So now we do the same trick. We do the same trick, okay? So here is a 1/2 here. So now we know that this is a function of finite order. So now we start at real S big. So we start real S big and not big. So where this is absolutely convergent, where is absolutely convergent. So now the trick is you move one by one. You move one by one. So here, we started here. So this is absolutely convergent means that it's a bounded. So it's a clearly finite order. Now you can move by one. You can move by one using this. Okay? So then if you move by one, this thing will be a finite order in this range. And you can move one by one, only up 1/2. So there you imply that, so remember that IS pi RI, this is the quotient times R equals 1 through M, L 1 plus IS pi RI. Okay, so for real part of S is greater than N minus 1. Okay, and so this is absolutely convergent, so it's a bounded. And this is a finite order, so if you multiply, it will be a finite order. So this is a finite order for this range. So you move to the left one by one. So that will imply, so we have so this thing is a finite order for real part of S is greater than equal to 1/2. Okay. So this is Ls pi r1, L2s pi r2, da-da-da. Okay. So if a real part of s is greater than 1 half, this whole thing is the range is greater than 1. Okay. So if you have the following conjecture, so the conjecture is, so this is what Mark McGee and Gilbert were talking about. The conjecture is that this thing, inverse, is a finite order for real part of S is greater than 1. So if you can prove this, then you can divide this by this. You can divide by this. You can divide by whole thing. So then you will prove that this is finite order. So then we are done. We are done. Okay. But we don't have this conjecture. So we have to use the following theorem from complex analysis. So that's what it was, I think, difficult. So it's the following theorem. So since we do not have the conjecture. Yes? No, because in the left, we might have zeros. If we have a lot of zeros. If the cell function have a zero, then how can you conclude that? You cannot have finite order. Inverse.
I mean, there is a notion of there are one function
of finite
order.
But zero can be, there are infinitely many zeros. Okay, so the following theorem from complex analysis. So we'll use the following theorem from complex analysis. So let f z h g be analytic functions finite order for s greater than equal to 0. Z is x plus iy. So I'll use this variable z because I'm going to use later on z to be s minus 1 half. So we'll apply this theorem for z equals s minus half. Okay, so it's a finite order on the right half plane. And let g to be the quotient fz over hg. Okay, so number one, so assume that G is analytic for S greater than equal to 0, i.e. H has not 0 for X greater than equal to 0, then G is a finite order. For x greater than or equal to 0. And second, suppose g is entire, suppose further. Okay, so this is a continuation of the theorem. So suppose g is entire and there exists alpha and C such that G minus X plus IY, the absolute value is C e to the alpha X times absolute value of G X plus IY for any then G is a finer order. G is finer order in entire plane, basically. So it's finer order on the half plane, but this is finer order everywhere. Okay, so in order to apply this theorem, so you can see that in order to apply this theorem, all you have to do is that this R function is a quotient of two holomorphic functions of finite order. That's all we have to do. Okay? So we have to show that this thing is we can write as a quotient of two functions of finite order. Okay, so in order to do that, we use the non-constant term, the non-constant term of Eisenstein series. So remember non-constant term, E psi, S, F, E, P, this was product, okay, the partial function. And the product of Weaker function. Okay. And now we can control this local Weaker function in the following way. So if V is finite place, then this local Weaker function is a rational function. Rational function of cube V to the minus S and has no zero for real part of S is greater than or equal to zero. And second, if V is the infinite place and this Weaker function is entire, and of finer order for real S is greater than or equal to zero, and given S, we can choose this function. We can choose this function such that this has no zero. It's not zero. Okay. All right. So the following proposition. So this is one of the most difficult proposition in the paper. So this one uses Mass-Seldwick relation. I think this is the most difficult proposition in the paper. So this theorem is that this non-constant term of Eisenstein series is basically the ratio of two analytic functions of a finer order for real S bigger than or equal to zero. Okay, so they have to use the Mass-Seldwick relation, means the inner product of the truncated Eisenstein series, so alpha, and it's very delicate. Anyway. Okay, so if you combine these two propositions, you can see that the denominator is a function of finer order, quotient of finer order. So So this two implies that this is a ratio of two analytic function, a finite order for real S bigger than equal to 0. Okay, so now we use induction here. Okay, same technique, so we use induction. So what is induction hypothesis? Induction hypothesis is LS pi RI is of finer order for I is greater than or equal to 2. And we already assume that this is entire. So now assume that this is finite order, I greater than or equal to 2. So that's the induction hypothesis. And now we prove that the first error function is finite order. Okay, so this is a ratio of two analytic function. Now if you divide by second error function, so if you combine these two, now you can see that, so then the first error function, if you combine this, is a ratio of two analytic function of finer order. For real part of F is greater than or equal to 1/2. Okay, so we combine this with that induction hypothesis. Okay, so now we apply the theorem. So now we apply this theorem with G. Okay, so we apply the theorem. Theorem with G to be L Z plus 1/2 pi R1. So we apply the theorem with this function. Okay. So what is the functional equation? So functional equation says that LS pi R1 is epsilon pi S pi R1 1 minus S pi R1 tilde. Okay, I'll put it here. So here the epsilon factor is just C to the E to the alpha S. That's the epsilon factor. And so if you plug in, so L 1/2 minus Z pi R1 tilde, this is according to the property of a control gradient, so this is 1/2 minus Z complex conjugate pi R1, and the complete whole thing conjugate. Okay. So according to our definition, so this is Z minus Z, the whole thing complex conjugate, and this thing is G minus X plus IY, whole thing complex conjugate. Okay. And so this thing is, so this is this. Okay, so if you take absolute value, so g minus x plus iy, absolute value. If you take absolute value, then this is just the c e to the alpha x g x plus iy, absolute value. So we satisfy that condition there. And now we already know that this is entire. We already know this is entire. And this is the ratio of two analytic functions. And we satisfy this. So if you apply the theorem, then this is a finite order. Oh, no, this is theorem from the complex analysis. This two theorem. I don't know. this is not well known theorem from complex analysis. Okay, so now we have a holomorphy bounded in vertical street and a functional equation. So we have everything we need to apply the converse theorem. So let me write down the converse theorem one more time. So I'm sure you already know this by heart, but so let me write down the converse theorem of Cocktail and PS. Okay, so let me indicate what we need. Yeah. Okay, so I'm going to explain what we need in order to apply the converse theorem. Okay, so the converse theorem is suppose, so we have is an irreducible, admissible representation of GL and A, such that the central character is a Grossmann character of F. Yeah. And let S be a finite set of finite places, and let JSM be the set of cuspidal representations. So this will be the set of sigma. So sigma is a cuspidal representation of GLMA such that sigma V is unramified for V in S. Okay, suppose L S sigma pi is nice. Okay, I'm not going to write what nice means because Jim talked about many times. So nice for all sigma in J S m, here m 1, 2, up to n minus 2. And as I said, n minus 2 is not really necessary, just sheer convenience. I mean, we don't have to do much work, you know, that's the point. Okay, then, there exists an automorphic representation, pi prime, of GLN, such that pi v is equivalent to for all three not in S. Okay, so this is the converse theorem. Okay, so let me remind you of how we apply this converse theorem. Okay, so let me remind you of the functoriality of symmetric powers. Okay, so I'm not going to add what Jim talked about this morning, so I'm just going to give an explicit example. So, functoriality gives, so phi is this representation, GL M plus 1 C. So this is it's sometimes denoted by sim m. So this is the symmetric m symmetric power representation. Okay. And so suppose little pi is a cuspidal representation of GL2A. Okay. So now we use the local Langmuir correspondence. So for pi v, it's the local Langmuir. So pi v is by local Langmuir correspondence. This is parameterized by psi v by representation of Dahlin Bay group. So you can put the prime there, but I'm more used to SL2. So you get GL2C. So it's parameterized by this admissible homomorphism of Bayer-Dahlin group. I mean, this morning, Jim Cocker's lecture notes this, you can replace this by the prime. Okay? So it's the same thing. Okay, then, if you take composition of this, so you get sim m psi v. You just take a composition. So we have this admissible homomorphism. And then by local Langmuir again, now you apply local Langmuir correspondence for GL M plus 1, you will have a irreducible admissible representation of GL M plus 1. So this will be irreducible admissible representation of GL M plus 1 FV. So this, you can do that for each for each V. So you can do that for each V. So you combine all that. You can combine all that. So let pi pi V. And so this is the irreducible, admissible representation of GL n plus 1. So this will be irreducible, admissible representation of GL n plus 1 A. And now question is this automorphic? So that's the, basically Langlands functoriality is the Langlands functoriality. Is asked is pi automorphic. So is this automorphic representation? And so you can formulate, I mean there are different formulation of Langlands functoriality, but this will be the, as Jim said this morning, this is the easiest way to formulate functoriality. So I'm going to do that probably next time. Not only the symmetric powers, but also you can formulate this tensor product also. So I'm going to, again, you can formulate this tensor product, GL MC times GL NC to GL M N C. So this is the tensor product. Tensor product. And you get the same thing. So if pi 1 and pi 2, so pi 1 is pi 1 V, pi 2 is pi 2 V. So these are cuspidal representation of GL M A, and this cuspidal representation of GL N A. Okay, and so if you go through the same step, so from this, for each V, we get pi 1 V. So let me denote by this notation. This is called box times. In text notation, this is a box times. Okay, so then you get this notation. Okay, anyway, so you get this. So this is an irreducible, admissible representation of GL M N F V for each V. You get exactly the same thing. You just get the admissible homomorphism, and then take a composition, and then apply local Langlands correspondence. And then you get this. And then again, we can do the same thing. So pi 1 box times pi 2, this is the tensor product . So this is, again, irreducible admissible representation. And now Langlands functoriality is basically, is this automorphic. Okay? So it's pi 1, pi 2 automorphic. Okay, so that's the . Okay, so there are, I think, so far there are three methods in establishing functoriality. So first one, they claim that that's the most promising one is trace formula. trace formula people claim that that's the most promising one. Okay, I mean, trace formula method was successful in getting base change and automorphic induction. Okay. And the second one is the data correspondence. Right? So, I mean, it's not really functoriality, but anyway, it's a transfer between two groups. Data correspondence is another one. And we have the converse theorem. And converse theorem is really tailor-made, well-suited, answering this question. Yeah, exactly. Exactly, you have exactly that situation there. So what do we have to do to apply converse theorem? So we have to do the following. So we have to do in order to apply the converse theorem. So first of all, okay, so I will so let's say we have the following situation. So I'm gonna denote the left hand side H. I'm gonna denote the left hand side H. So we have the following situation. H is split reductive group. And we have this L homomorphism. So H can be here GL2, or in this case H is GLN times GLN. Okay. So H can be anything. And so let pi b be a cuspidal representation of h f b. So in our case, later I'm gonna take h to be the GL2 or GLM times GLN, or I'm gonna take GL4 later. So, and phi will be the x-square square, okay? So this is a tensor product and this is symmetric powers, okay? Okay, so then, so suppose we get, we get pi. So this is an irreducible, admissible representation of GL capital N A. Okay, so we apply the local Langlands correspondence. So this is local Langlands correspondence. Okay, so in order to apply the converse theorem, we have to do the following thing. First of all, the very first thing you have to do is whether that L function is available. Okay? So let me look at, so for all V, gamma S, sigma V, pi V, rho M, tensor pi, psi V, gamma, sigma V, pi V, psi V, L, S sigma here the rho m is just the standard L function of GLMC. Okay, and analytic meromorphic continuation, and the functional equation for LS sigma pi rho m tensor phi. 3 entire is entire. So m goes to, and everything has to be, everything has to, m goes to 1 through n minus 2. And fourth, so this is a bounded in Perikard string. Okay, so in order to apply converse theorem, we have to do these things. Okay, so first of all, we have to see whether this L function is available from Langmuir-Schrödinger method. Because we cannot get these things, meromorphic continuation and this information, we cannot get it from Langmuir-Schrödinger method if that L function doesn't show up in our list. Okay? So for example, we'll not have this L function if H is, if H is GL3 cross GL3. If GL3 cross GL3, what is this L function looks like? This is the, you are asking for triple product L function of GL3, GL3 and GLM. M going from 1 through 7. And we don't have that. We don't have an L function. We, at most, we have a GL2. We don't have a triple product L function, GL3, GL3, GL3. So, you cannot apply that. You cannot at most apply GL2 here. So that's what I'm going to talk about that next week. Okay, so let me write down the example here, right here. That's why I'm going to have the symmetric square. For GL2, we can twist up to GL5. Yeah. So I'm going to do a symmetric square. Symmetric square. Okay, so rather than do a symmetric square, I'm going to do a so-called adjoint. Adjoint. Adjoint is, so basically, it's going to SO3. So basically, symmetric square is basically the adjoint square, adjoint twist by the central character. So pi is the central character. So I will prove that this is a functorial. Yeah? So I can, so we can do that. So in this specific example, so in this case, what L function do we need? We need this L function. We need this L function. Adjoint pi twist by a character. So we need this L function. Or you can write this as a adjoint twist by the character. Of course, we have to GL3, so we only have to twist by GL1. Okay? GL1. Of course, we can twist GL2, but so where does this R function show up? That R function shows up in a Langmuir-Schrödinger method. Okay. So this R function, yes. So this shows up in the following, from SP4, a non-Ziegler parabolic, so show up F cross, so GL1 cross SL2 inside SP4. So this is a non-Ziegler parabolic subgroup. And so if you put chi here, tensor with pi prime, where pi prime is irreducible constituents it is sort of constituents of pi restrict to SL2. So if you restrict pi to SL2, it decomposes a direct sum and a cluster representation of SL2, and just pick anyone. Pick anyone. And so if you shows up in SL2. Thinking diagram, just this. This is SP4. So we are getting rid of this. GL2, yeah. But this is the Levy. This is the Levy. And so if you form Eisenstein series, so then the constant term, then the in the constant term you get only that I function shows up. So constant term will look like the global intertwining operator will look like S adjoint pi twist by chi. S plus 1 adjoint pi twist by chi. So you have only one L function shows up in here. And if you want to twist by GL2, then you just put GL2 and SP6. If you put GL2, then you have a GL2 twist by adjoint square, and adjoint representation. So, but it's not necessary because we have a strong converse theorem. Okay, so you have to first make sure that that L function, this L function shows up. We have the this, okay. And so number two, this has been known for a long time. Right, this is due to Shahidi. Number two has been known for a long time, okay. For more than 10 years. And number four is due to, this is as I just explained, this is Gelbart and Jacquet, I mean Shahidi. And number three, it's not true in general, okay. So, number three is not true for arbitrary sigma. So the trick, this is trick where the trick of twisting by Grossian character, which is high ramified at certain place, comes from here. So this entire four sigma in S M. Now you twist by Grossian character. So eta is Grossian character. Where eta v is high ramified. At one place. At one place in S. So eta will be just fixed throughout applying converse theorem. So actually we are applying converse theorem. The modified version here, eta.
The modified version. All right. I explained number three, why it's entire last week. So everything is okay. Now number one is not obvious. Number one, it looks obvious, but it's not obvious.
Because the right-hand side, remember that this right-hand side is
defined by integral representation. Remember that, how these are defined? This is defined as GCD. Of all the integrals. Yeah. But the left-hand side, you defined as a normalizing factor of intertwining operators. You remember that? We first define gamma factors, and then you take L function to be the numerator. Okay. So these are defined in a completely different way. So the equality is not that obvious. And indeed, I cannot show this for this situation. So for example, so number one is not obvious. So one is not obvious. So I mean, this case, I'm going to just explain very soon. In this case, it's okay. But number one is not obvious. For example, if phi is x tria square, so you get GL4, GL6. So this is x tria square. So in that case, I cannot show that. I cannot show, and the pi v is a supercusped. The supercusped representation of GL4 FV. And so I don't know how to show. So that the gamma factors equal. So S pi V extra square pushed by a character, this is equal to pi V tensor with pi. So if it is supercusped, then the equality of gamma factors will imply equality of L function. So we only have to show equality of gamma factors. And I don't know how to show this. Okay, so this is the Rankine-Solberg. Okay, so on the left hand side is, this is defined by Langlands-Shahid method. Okay. So I don't know how to show that. So one is not that obvious. Okay, so now, but in this case, this is easy because, okay, so. Because of this condition here, unverified. So by multiplicative of gamma factors, we only have to show for character. We reduce to the character. So this is very handy. Yeah? This condition is very handy. Okay. For example, we don't have that problem. We don't have number one. We don't have the number one problem if H is GLM cross GLN. We don't have that problem because by multiplicative of gamma factors, at the bad place, sigma is unverified, so both sides becomes just the product of just the Rankine-Solberg function of GLM cross GLN. So so we don't have the problem. Okay, so now I'll finish the proof of this contoriality. Okay, so we have this adjoint pi. Okay, so this is the we are not sure that this is the automorphic representation of GL3. So that's the goal. Okay, so in this case, for any Grossmann character, chi L S pi pi tilde
let me, chi pi tilde.
So any Grossmann character, this Rankine server, L function becomes L adjoint pi tensor chi L S chi. So you factor in this way. Okay. And same with the gamma factors. So in that case, we already know gamma factors for this Hacker function. So that number one, we don't have any problem. So definition of the gamma factors is canonical. So
what it means is that, so S chi V and gamma factors are psi V are canonical. So these are Artin L functions, L and gamma factors.
Okay, so we have everything we need. We already showed 1, 2, 3, 4. I mean, these are just canonical factors. Yeah, yeah. Okay, so because these things are by Scheide's work, these are Art and L function. Yeah, that's right. I mean, these are can be defined by Langmann Scheide method. We can define that. And Scheide has shown that this is canonical factors. Yeah, that's right. So it's a canonical factor, so you just divide by that. Okay, anyway, so we have 1, 2, 3, 4, but also we know that this thing is entire. Okay, so you know, let me distinguish. Okay, so this is entire if chi square is not trivial. Okay, so we can show that this L function is entire. Because in the Langmann-Scheide method here, the W naught, the bar group element, sends to just the inverse of that. So if chi square is not trivial, this is not invariant. So if chi square is not trivial. So if it's not invariant, then this is entire. I mean, this is holomorphic for real S bigger than zero, then you can show that this is entire. Okay, so now we can apply converse theorem. Okay, we matched all place, 1, 2, 3, 4. Now we have this converse theorem. So now we apply converse theorem. Theorem 2, this one, and now we have to choose the finite place. So we'll apply it two times. And S1, you just take any, so V1 and V2 are any finite place. So we'll apply converse theorem twice. So if you apply twice, then you get an automorphic representation. So then we'll get we obtain an automorphic representation. We have two open automorphic representations, pi 1 and pi 2, such that pi 1 v is equivalent to adjoint pi v for v not equal to v1, and pi 2 v is equivalent to pi 2 v for v not in v2. And now we apply strong multiplicity 1. So we apply strong multiplicity 1. So strong multiplicity 1. So pi 1 and pi 2 are equivalent. And this adjoint pi. So then we prove that this adjoint representation is automorphic. Okay. And this is not useful yet. It's not useful. Okay. So we have to make it precise, more precise what they are, what it is. Okay, so the it's not cuspidal in general. Not cuspidal, no.
And the strong multiplicity 1 theorem relies on.
Well, there's also strong multiplicity 1 for
automorphic representation.
There's the generalized. So if it's not cuspidal, it's induced from cuspidal.
Okay, then you go back.
And all those cuspidals. Okay.
So it will not be cuspidal. It will not be cuspidal. It was a pi's monomial. That's what I'm going to show. Okay, so now we, yes? Yeah, that's right, okay, but anyway, this is not useful yet. Okay, so we don't know what they are. Okay, we don't know whether this is a. But anyway, we use classification, the classification of automorphic representations. Of GLN. GLN. So, I think Jim talked about this. Any automorphic representation is basically a subquotient of induced representation. So, at pi is equivalent to a subquotient of this induced representation. Sigma 1, determinant of R1, sigma k, determinant of Rk. Here Ri, you can assume that Ri is real, and the sigma I are unitary, the cuspidal representation of GL and I. Okay, GL3, so yeah, I mean, we don't know whether it's three components or two, one component, we don't know that, okay? So now, in order to be useful, we have to show that these are all zero. These experiments are all zero. So we need R1, Rk are all zero. So basically, I mean, that's what is expected. We're not sure that this is a unitary induction from
unitary cuspidal representation. So this is where we have to use the following trick. So we have to use so-called weak Ramanujan property. Okay? So let me... Oh, okay, yeah. I mean, we have a GL2 and GL1, or GL1, GL1, GL1.
Let's say GL1, GL1,
GL1. Yes.
And we have some R and minus R and then
0. Yeah, you can do that, yes. Okay. But that's not possible. That's what I'm going to show right now.
Okay.
That's not possible. Why do you have to show that these are zero? Because you know to be useful. Because if it is not zero, for example, this can be reducible. For example, if it is 1/2 and minus 1/2, for example, then this induced representation is reducible. Then this is, we only know that it's a subquotient. So, but if it's zero, then this will be always irreducible. This whole thing is irreducible. So this thing is actually equal to this whole induced representation. Okay. So so in this case, so that means that this is irreducible. So then it is irreducible and also generic. And unitary. So, so that will give us the bound for free coefficients, for example. So this is how you get the 1/4 bound. So for example, you start with the induced representation of R minus R, for example, mu. Then the, what is the adjoint pi? Adjoint pi V is the induced this is the quotient of induced representation of 2R, 1, minus 2R. Okay? So the adjoint pi B is the quotient of this. Okay? So if you show that these are all zero, so that means that this is generic. Generic means that it has to be, this has to be irreducible. So what the, and unitary. So that means that 2R is less than 1/4. I mean 1/2. In order to be irreducible and unitary, and by the classification of unitary representation, it has to be, so you get R is less than 1/4. So you get this, bound. Yeah? That's how you get the Galbraith-Jacquet obtained 1/4 bound. So this, you have to show this is zero. Okay, so in order to show this, we need the following I call weak Ramanujan property. Okay, and I think this is originally Carter and P.S., they call weakly Ramanujan, but I called it. And also, their version is slightly different than what I'm going to write. Okay, so we're going to have the property of cuspidal representations of GLN. Or you can generalize the automorphic, but let me just write down for cuspidal representation. So pi, this is a cuspidal representation of GLN, and let's say pi V is spherical representation, and with a semi-simple conjugates class. Alpha 1, the diagonal of alpha 1 V, alpha n V. Okay. So the definition is pi satisfies weak Ramanujan property. And of course, the Ramanujan conjecture is that all these are absolute value 1. I mean, that's too much to ask right now. So we ask something weaker. The property, if given epsilon, there exists a density zero set T epsilon, depending on epsilon, such that the maximum of alpha I V absolute value alpha I V inverse, the maximum of all that is less than equal to Q V epsilon. So all this absolute value and the inverses are bounded by this for V not in. So outside the density zero set, all the Fourier coefficients are very small. Okay, so the theorem is that these are true. So the cusped representations of GL2, GL3, and GL4 satisfy a weak Ramanujan property. Okay, so for GL2 and GL3, it's fairly easy. It's just an easy consequence of the absolute convergence of this Godwin-Jacquet function, real less greater than 1. But GL4 is a little more difficult. Okay. Let's just say it involves, you have to use the extra square list of GL4. Okay, I'm going to mention briefly. But anyways, we have that. So that means, so then this is very easy because pi satisfies weak Ramanujan, so then adjoint pi. So adjoint pi satisfies weak Ramanujan. Because if a pi V, Satake parameter is alpha V and beta V, then adjoint pi is Satake parameter is alpha V, beta V inverse, 1, alpha V inverse, beta V. And you can see easily that the absolute value of all that is bounded by Q V epsilon, or 2 epsilon at most. Okay. So, this satisfies weak Ramanujan. So, if you look at this carefully, in order that this satisfies weak Ramanujan, all I should be all zero. Okay? So you can check very easily. Okay.
Actually, I mean, the concept we introduced that notion exactly to this argument.
Oh, okay. Oh, good. Yeah, lift will be all unitary, yeah. Oh, I just made it up. Okay, so
Okay, so let me make a final, give me just one moment. Let me just finally make a remark when it is cuspid, the adjoint. So now we look at this L functions here. So left hand side has a pole. This has a pole if and only if this is equivalent to pi. This has a pole. This has a pole at 1 if and only if this is true. Okay, and let's say chi is not trivial. Let's say chi is not trivial. So if chi is not trivial and this is true, then this has a pole. But then this does not have a pole. So that means that this must have a pole. Okay. So if this has a pole, means that the adjoint representation, this is not a cuspid. So this is exactly the definition of a monomial representation. This is exactly monomial representation. So in this case, if pi tensor chi is pi, and chi is not trivial. So this is definition of monomial. Then this is not cuspid. And namely, adjoint pi is chi inverse. So one of sigma has to be chi inverse. One of sigma has to be chi inverse. And then the other component, some tau, some automorphic, this is automorphic representation of GL2. Okay. So that's the Gelbart-Jacquet result. All right, so next time I'll prove the functoriality of that the tensor product GL2 cross GL3. So that will give us the functoriality of symmetric cube. And also I'll prove the functoriality of X-ray square. So I'll basically briefly explain how to get around this problem. And that will give us the functoriality of the symmetric force. Okay. So then I'll conclude that.